Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, and welcome back to the History of Egypt podcast. This is The Pyramid Texts Explained. This is the concluding chapter in our mini-series about the Pyramid Texts of King Unas. Today, I want to dive into what it all means, what the core themes of the texts are, where they come from, how the ancients conceived and organized them, and how Egyptologists have reached the understandings that they do. This is going to be a slightly disjointed episode as we go from topic to topic, but hopefully it will give a greater depth and meaning to what we have heard so far. If you're interested in a particular topic, there'll be chapter codes in the episode description. I'll also include a proper bibliography in the description of the episode, because many of the academic sources that I'll be using here are accessible online, and I know some people will be interested to learn more. So with that out of the way, let's cut to the chase. What's the deal with the pyramid texts? The pyramid texts may appear to be incredibly complicated, full of obscure metaphors and references, and with a language style that goes all over the place, from elaborate descriptions of the gods to the endless repetition of certain rituals or phrases. This can obscure the core meaning, but the actual idea at the heart of the pyramid texts is relatively simple. The core idea is that the deceased, the king, is going to ascend to the sky, to join or rejoin the gods, and to sit beside the great solar deity Ra on his boat as he sails across the sky. There are additional themes and metaphors that turn up through the pyramid texts, but this is the core idea. When the ruler of Egypt dies, he must travel to the stars in order to join the gods and perpetuate the solar cycle. If that's the core idea, then why does it not come across more strongly in the texts themselves? The challenge for modern readers is that the pyramid texts are not a narrative. They do not record or tell a story in a straightforward or orderly fashion. Instead, the pyramid texts are built around a whole series of smaller, disparate sections. They might be interconnected and they might feed on one another, but they don't flow in an obviously logical fashion. That can be quite challenging, especially for Western readers. For the past 200 to 300 years, scholars have tended to present mythologies, say the Greek and the Roman ones, in long, elaborate stories. Those might not be exactly reflective of the ancient sources, but it's such a common trend within popular and scholarly history in the West that it can make the pyramid texts a really dense and obscure set of passages. So it helps to think of these not as a mythology or as a straightforward tale. Instead, the pyramid texts are more like guides, a set of ritual passages with specific uses and functions. In that context, the world of the divine and the mythology of the gods themselves does show up here and there, but it mostly does so to enhance the meaning of the individual rituals. So the story of Ra, Osiris, Seth, and Horus, those are relevant and they crop up here and there, but they're not the core focus of what the pyramid texts are achieving. So to put it very simply, the meaning of the pyramid texts is to help the deceased, in particular the king, travel to the sky to join the gods. The rituals. The pyramid texts achieve their primary aim through a series of rituals. These are probably rites or ceremonies that were conducted by priests when they were performing funerals for the deceased. But these rites have been brought together, consolidated, within the body of the pyramid texts. And over the past 120 years, scholars have been able to piece together the core rituals which are presented here. These include the reassembly of the king's individual body parts, which have become separated by his death. The separation has occurred metaphorically, but the king's limbs, his head, his eyes, his mouth, his faculties, and his spirit must all be knitted together again, both physically by the process of mummification, but also ritually through the spells and utterances contained in these texts. The second ritual is the purification of the king's body and his soul, or Ba. No one can enter the world of the gods, or even a temple, without undergoing a purification, washing away the dirt of the earthly world, or the rot of death. This purification can be achieved in a variety of ways, through washing the body with water and natron salts, through the application or anointing of oils, the burning of incense to fumigate the air, and the verbal declaration of the purification itself. Words, especially writing, have magic in ancient Egyptian thought, so the speaking of purification is another valid and important way to achieve it. The third ritual, which is present throughout the text, is the identification of the king with Osiris. On earth, every ruler is the incarnation of Horus, the sky god, and the son of Osiris. But upon death, the king will transform into a new identity. He will become the king of the dead, the foremost of the Westerners, or deceased. And the pyramid texts repeatedly invoke this idea that following his physical death on earth, the king ascends to a new life, the life of Osiris. The fourth ritual is the protection of the king's tomb and body from dangerous beings and spirits. These include serpents or malevolent gods, who must be driven away and expelled from the sacred realm. One interesting feature that was pointed out to me in an article is that because the floor of the king's tomb is not decorated with hieroglyphs, the passages on the walls have to make a special effort to ensure that that area, the floor, is swept clean of any of the creepy crawlies that might invade the sanctum. Serpents, insects, lizards, and rodents might find their way into the burial chamber or storage rooms, and the spells, especially on the west wall of the burial chamber and the east wall of the antechamber, kind of provide a shield around the tomb in order to drive those animals away. It's an interesting feature that I hadn't really thought about. You walk on the floor and you don't think about the fact that it's not decorated, but that area needs protection too, and the texts on those spells make a special effort for it. The fifth ritual, and arguably one of the most important, is the presenting or offering of food, drink, and protective items. These offering rituals appear, for Unas, on the north wall of the burial chamber, and they are a fundamental part of the overall system. If the king is traveling to the next world, he needs his supplies and provisions. On earth, the priests are going to make those offerings in the temples, and for the ordinary people, one would hope that their descendants, their family members, would make such offerings on their behalf. But should those offerings fail, should the temples close or become ruined, the presence of these hieroglyphs on the wall will provide a magical equivalent, and the king himself will use those texts to make offerings to the gods. Every being, no matter how great, needs their provisions. Everyone gets a cut. The next ritual is the reversion of offerings, that is, the return of the items to the offering bearer after they have been used in the ritual. I touched on this in part 3, but the basic idea is that when you have physically offered an item to the gods, say bread, beer, or meat, the item itself still remains physically intact, so the priests would then take those items after they had been consecrated. They would distribute them amongst themselves, and that would be an important part of their wages for performing these duties. The king himself will do this within the next world. He will make the offerings magically to the gods, but then he will consume those items himself as part of his sustenance and rewards. The reversion of offerings is an important part of the ancient Egyptian economy of religion. I'll do an episode about it in the future because it was an important part of my master's research and I'd quite like to revisit it and share it with you. Anyway, the reversion of offerings is the sixth key ritual. Next, we have the identification of deities. This appears throughout the pyramid texts. The king, Unas, will address individual gods by name. He will describe their major properties or the places in which they dwell. This identification is important. It is a way of seeing the deities and a way of giving them power. For the ancient Egyptians, names were incredibly important. To know the true name of something was to have power over it, or at the very least, to have an intimate connection with it. So when Osiris greets a particular deity, say Geb, he might describe him in different ways as the earth shaker or the one who holds things in their places. This identification is absolutely essential, for without their proper names and identities, the gods themselves lose something of their power. And if Unas does not know those names, then he is going to have much more trouble entering the divine realm. Incidentally, for fans of fantasy novels, this concept of naming something and having power over it is a key concept in the book The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. That author undertook many studies in magic and religious systems, so it wouldn't surprise me if the ancient Egyptian concept filtered into his work somehow. Hopefully it won't take Rothfuss 4,500 years to finish his work, but if nothing else, you can look at the pyramid texts for more of that system. The eighth important ritual goes along with the identification of deities. In this next one, the deities themselves acknowledge the king. They see him and they welcome him to the divine world. The acknowledgement of the deceased, by speaking his name, embracing him, and describing his powers within the next world, is an essential component of the pyramid texts. It is, arguably, one of their major functions, along with the protection of the body and the presentation of offerings. When Unas travels to the realm of the gods, he must have powers that are proportional, even equal to those deities, otherwise he will not be able to achieve his proper place. And so, in the ancient Egyptian system, the gods themselves greet Unas, they see him, and they describe his names and the powers which he will enjoy. Doing this, and carving the descriptions of it on the walls, gives it a magical reality, so that when the king does travel to his eternal home, he can enjoy those gifts. Next, we have the king's place. Unas will ascend to the sky, but he's not just going to float there. Repeatedly, we hear references to Unas taking his throne or seat. The king is going to a specific place. That place might be on the boat of Ra, or it might be amid the stars in a nebulous sense. But when he arrives, he is going to take up his throne as a king in the next world, just as he was in ours. This throne is described variously as the throne of Osiris, the throne of Ra, or the throne of Geb, three of the most important deities within the pyramid texts. But it all boils down to the same core principle. Unas is going to take up a seat of utmost majesty and power, one that he deserves for his incredible strength on earth, but more importantly, one that he must hold in order to have the necessary power to ensure that nature and reality continues. When Unas is a god in the sky, he is going to help our world to flourish and to persist. In order to do that, he must have his proper place of authority, and that is symbolized by his throne. Incidentally, the throne itself appears in the names of Osiris and Isis, two of the major deities associated with the afterlife and the death of the king. So the concept of the throne, the place of power, is absolutely core to the ancient Egyptian belief of divine authority. In fact, you will find that same hieroglyph in the name of Unas's pyramid itself. The name of the pyramid, which we learn from hieroglyph texts, is Nefer Sut Onis. This translates as perfect or beautiful are the places of Unas. But the second word there, Sut, that is spelled in hieroglyphs with a throne. In this case, it is three thrones side by side, which gives the plural meaning. But the idea of a throne as the king's place, that concept is so important that the pyramid itself is named for it. Finally, the last major ritual is the king sitting alongside and identifying with the gods. Once he has reached the sky and taken his throne, the king is an equal to other major deities, He is particularly identified with Osiris, the king of the dead, Ra, the sun, and Geb, the earth lord. So, in effect, Unas becomes a being with power over all the major cosmic realms, our world, the world of the earth, the sun, which dominates the sky, and the mysterious land of the dead, which is Osiris' kingdom. So throughout the pyramid texts, Unas is explicitly associated with those three major deities. He is identified with other minor deities along the way, but these are the three big ones and the three most common references. Put that all together, the reassembly of the king's body parts, the purification of his body and soul, his identification with Osiris, the protecting of the tomb, the presentation and reversion of offerings, the identification of deities and their acknowledgement of the king, taking up his throne and sitting alongside the great gods, you get a sense of the journey as it is presented through rituals. The pyramid texts cover all the major areas which Unas's body and soul are concerned with: the tomb itself, which requires purification and protection, the temple, in which the offerings will be made, and the sky realm, to which Unas is traveling to meet his divine comrades and to join them in power. So we get a clear sense of place, different areas where the king's soul will travel and which are important to his immortality. As I said, these rituals are not presented in the tomb in a straightforward linear fashion. These references are scattered throughout different rooms. Sometimes they repeat, and sometimes you'll find the sequel to one ritual in a different section of the monument. So these rituals do not map exactly onto the walls of the pyramid, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. Egyptologists have pieced these together by studying the texts in as greater detail as possible, by unpacking every sentence and hieroglyph, and seeing where they rhyme, how they match up to one another, where different phrases might recur, or where different concepts parallel one another. It's a work in progress. We definitely can't say that scholars perfectly understand the pyramid texts. They understand them better now than they did 120 years ago, but there is always more to learn, both in the sense of the rituals and ideas that are presented, and the different divine realms which are described. Speaking of realms, the pyramid texts do present a clear, well-defined geography for the divine world. This geography is similar to the earthly world, although located in the sky. We get references to fields of marshes or reeds, to lakes, rivers, deserts, and mountains. We get references to animals, like serpents, bulls and cows, birds, and the deities themselves, who appear on earth in their physical avatars. However, the geography of the divine world is similar to ours, but it's not identical. It has been twisted and mutated in certain ways. We get references to lakes of fire, and deities of immense violence and power, who slaughter millions and who bathe in their blood. Now, sometimes that might reflect the earthly world, but the Egyptian afterlife, or Duat, is clearly intended to be a sort of darker mirror to ours. It is mutated in certain ways, which make it unfamiliar and more unknowable. The idea here might be to invoke a sense of mystery. According to one scholar, Jennifer Hellam, the pyramid texts create, quote, a dissimilarity strong enough to render the familiar unfamiliar, and perhaps instilling more terror than wonder in the minds of the worshippers, end quote. Basically, anybody listening to these texts should get an idea of the divine world as similar to ours, but also unfathomably different and powerful. And whether you are a priest reciting these texts in a temple, or a mourner standing at a funeral as the priest speaks these words out loud, you should get a sense of otherworldliness. Something that is recognizable and yet so different from our world that you have no choice but to pray. This mystery is an important part of ancient Egyptian religion. Because many of these texts are written down in hieroglyphs or other forms, 99% of the earthly population could not read them. Literacy was astoundingly low in the ancient world, and that gave the priests, or the literate ones, an incredible advantage over ordinary mortals. A learned priest or a text was a source of mysterious arcane knowledge, And if there is one thing we can say reliably about humans, it's that when they do not know something, their imagination tends to fill it in with far more color than the reality might demand. So the obscurity of the Egyptian afterlife, its mystery and its twistedness, that is part of the idea. It is supposed to be unknowable, because being unknowable, it seems all the more divine, and its representatives on earth, the priests and the king, also become far more mysterious or wise to their followers and congregations. So the Egyptian afterlife has a geography that is similar to our own, but twisted in certain fundamental ways, and that enhances its divine aura. So Egyptologists studying the pyramid texts in detail can unpack certain features of its geography, the rituals described within, and the core meanings of the text. Now, let's look at the more earthly or mundane elements. First up, origins. The pyramid texts are the oldest known corpus of religious literature from ancient Egypt, and they first appear in the monument of King Unas at Saqqara. But where do the texts themselves come from? Did Unas invent them, or are they older? We don't have an exact answer to that question, but there are clues, mainly in the language. Like any language ever, the ancient Egyptian language evolved over time. From the earliest periods, the pre-dynastic and Old Kingdom, to the last lingering uses under the Roman Empire, the language changed and developed across generations. At a glance, just looking at hieroglyphs, those changes might not be apparent, but scholars do have a solid understanding of the phases that the ancient Egyptian language evolved. Thanks to 200 plus years of study, Egyptologists can observe how hieroglyphs of the Old Kingdom differ from those of the New Kingdom, how the grammar or syntax changes, how certain words get used in different contexts, or even change entirely in the meaning. Scholars can also observe differences within each major period. For example, the pyramid texts first show up around 2350 BCE during the Old Kingdom. If you take the pyramid texts and compare them to other hieroglyphs from the Old Kingdom, there are clear and visible differences. These differences might be as small as the spelling of individual words, or it might be the grammar of entire sentences, the use of particular verbs and adjectives. It's all incredibly academic, and I won't bore you with it here. If you're interested in the minutiae, a scholar named James Allen is publishing a complete language study of the pyramid texts. The first volume, about the Pyramid of Unas, is available to buy online at a fairly reasonable price. I'll put a reference in the episode description. Anyway, the language of the pyramid texts themselves hints at an older origin. One example is the pronouns. In some passages, the hieroglyphs always refer to the deceased in the third person. They might say Unas, the Osiris Unas, King Unas, or him, and so forth. But then they sometimes switch abruptly to the first person, I, me, my, etc. And they don't always refer to the deceased as a king. This suggests that, originally, the pyramid texts were more generic, funeral texts used by priests for any deceased person. If somebody died and they wanted their soul to be transported to the next world, the funerary priest might perform a version of these texts for their benefit. That is speculative. As I said, the pyramid texts are the oldest surviving religious literature, so we don't have a physical example to compare. But that little feature in the language does indicate that they have an earlier origin than the tomb of Unas himself, and that origin is not necessarily royal. Another giveaway can be found in the hieroglyphs. Occasionally, the passages will forget to name the deceased, and instead they'll have a little phrase that says, "insert name here," or something along those lines. For example, in utterance 215-215, the passage says, quote, "You belong, whoever, to that god," end quote. That whoever, or men in ancient Egyptian, indicates that the original text has been edited by whoever is decorating the tomb of Unas. For scholars, it's a giveaway. The pyramid texts are not Unas' invention. They come from a pre-existing corpus, one that, apparently, could be used by whoever. That begs the question, are the pyramid texts, quote-unquote, actually for pyramids specifically, or are they just funeral texts that happen to only appear in pyramids? The answer is a bit of both. During the Old Kingdom, from Unas onwards, the pyramid texts show up exclusively in the royal tombs. You will not find them in the monuments of officials or non-royal people, only pyramids for kings and queens. Later, the pyramid texts get adopted and used by other people. They get remixed and added to later books, like the coffin texts, the Book of the Dead, and so forth. But during the Old Kingdom, they are, so far, only found in royal tombs. But as I said, the language of these texts hints at an older and more widespread source. The best guess is that, originally, the pyramid texts come from the temples. Not just any temples, but temples serving the dead. It is a fair bet that, during a funeral, a priest would read these kinds of passages from a papyrus. That papyrus would be incredibly rare, a highly valued and secretive text, but it wasn't necessarily only used for kings. Perhaps the priests would use these to conduct a burial, in exchange for a share of the offerings or some kind of donation to the temple. That is speculative on my part, but the language of the texts, and the little inconsistencies in that language, suggest that these texts were in use for a long time before Unas decided to carve them in his pyramid. One interesting feature is that the people carving these texts on the walls clearly were not actually literate themselves. Because the pyramid texts survive from about 11 monuments, we have a fairly robust corpus of hieroglyphs to compare. And scholars have identified numerous mistakes within the pyramid texts, small errors in the individual glyphs. For example, an artist might accidentally draw a feather, I, when he meant to draw a piece of linen, S, or a basket, K, when he meant to draw a bowl, Neb. Small mistakes like these suggest two things. Firstly, the sculptors themselves were not literate. They did not know exactly what they were carving. Instead, they were probably copying these texts from a master source, a papyrus, held by a priest or official. Studying that papyrus, and then copying it onto the walls, the artists did not exactly know what they were writing. And when you add the difficulty of doing all of this in the dark, by lamplight, with a papyrus that might have difficult handwriting, well, we can forgive a few mistakes here and there. For scholars, though, these mistakes, which are random and vary from pyramid to pyramid, those are like fingerprints, clues to the human origin of the texts. God, I love this. So the pyramid texts almost certainly come from temple and funerary rituals that existed before Unas' time. How much older are they? 100 years? 200? 500? That we can't say. Until we find a physical example of religious texts from an earlier generation, we can only speculate on the exact time period in which they were composed. Realistically, the pyramid texts probably accumulated over many generations, individual utterances or rituals that were eventually compiled to use in different funerals. But again, that is purely speculative. Hopefully, future excavations will find a scrap of papyrus, a block with inscriptions, or some tiny fragment that includes part of a pyramid text. Until then, the monument of Unas remains the earliest known example.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Finally, we have the arrangement of the texts themselves. Because these are religious writings, you might expect that they have a kind of logical order or pattern in their arrangement. Text number one should appear next to text number two, three, and four, right? Well, strangely enough, no. So far, the pyramid texts have been found in 11 monuments. There might be more, but these are the ones that archaeologists have discovered. Those monuments are all royal, and they all include a selection of the pyramid texts. Is each of these monuments identical to the others? No. In fact, every single pyramid with these texts is unique. The pyramid texts do not have an obvious system or order to their placement. When the same utterances or spells appear in different monuments, they won't appear in the same place. One text might appear on the wall of a burial chamber, but in another pyramid, it's in the antechamber or the corridor. Then we have inclusions and omissions. The Pyramid of Unas is the earliest one discovered, and that includes a relatively large corpus. I mean, it took me long enough to read. But surprisingly, the later pyramids do sometimes add new, quote-unquote, texts, or they'll omit them. The Pyramid of Pepi I, for example, has most of the texts that we find under King Unas, but a couple are missing and a couple have been added in their place. Surprisingly, each pyramid has a unique arrangement and placement of their pyramid texts. Scholars have tried to untangle this and figure out if there is any kind of rule or system for their placement. One noteworthy study was a PhD dissertation by Dr. Jennifer Hellam in 2001, link in the episode description. The result, in short, was that there is no currently discernible rule for where the text should be placed. It seems that each individual ruler chose the text they wanted to be in their monument, perhaps based on preference or their own priorities. The result is a complete absence of any rule or obvious system. A really good example of this is the sarcophagus. The Pyramid of Unas has the earliest pyramid texts, but the king's sarcophagus within his burial chamber, that is entirely undecorated. There are no hieroglyphs on it. But the successor of Unas, King Teti, he did include hieroglyphs in his sarcophagus. Apparently, every ruler did it slightly differently. Unfortunately, the pyramid texts do not really explain themselves. They don't have captions saying, "This is why these texts are on this wall." It was obvious to the people who were commissioning these monuments, but they didn't feel any need to explain. The upshot of all of this is that Egyptological scholarship has changed a lot when it comes to the pyramid texts. The hieroglyphs themselves were first discovered in 1881. That is when an archaeologist named Gaston Maspero first opened and entered the Pyramid of Pepi I. Before that, the major pyramids that were studied were the Giza pyramids, or Abu Sir, or the Step Pyramid at Saqqara. The later pyramids of the 5th and 6th dynasties, those hadn't been opened yet, and it wasn't until Maspero went into Pepi's pyramid that he suddenly found the pyramid texts. Following that, there was a mad scramble of archaeology to open up the other pyramids and see if they also had the hieroglyphs. That is how we found the texts within Unas, Teti, Merenra, and Pepi II, and so forth. The first publications of the pyramid texts were scattered across the archaeological reports as each pyramid was excavated. It took more than 20 years for a proper systematic publication. From 1908 to 1922, a German scholar named Kurt von Seth published the Altägyptische Pyramidentext in four volumes. Seth died before completing the work, and other scholars finished it from his notes. But that text was a landmark. It was the first time that somebody had compiled all of the pyramid texts that were known into one single volume, and that allowed scholars to compare and examine the texts in far more convenience and detail. Over the 20th century, we had a flood of scholarly works, usually based on individual monuments. A lot of this work was done in French. For example, the publication of the Unas Pyramid was by Alexander Piankov in 1968. And from the late 20th century up till now, the French Institute of Archaeology has been the major force working to conserve, restore, and document the pyramid texts themselves. The French Institute, or IFAO, is currently doing a complete republication of the pyramid texts. These have been appearing since 2010, and they're quite detailed and robust. But comparing the first discovery, 1881, to the complete re-examination, 2010, you can get a sense of how long this project actually takes. It's a real work in progress. For one thing, the pyramid texts are an enormous corpus, with 11 monuments identified so far, and each one of those takes a heck of a lot of work to study and document. Then we have the grammar element. The Egyptological understanding of Egyptian language and grammar has improved massively over the past 120 years. Today, scholars have a far more nuanced and detailed understanding of the different phases of the ancient Egyptian language, and because of this, they are able to dive down deeper into how certain passages or texts are constructed, how the sentences operate, and how best to translate them. So today, scholars are getting closer to the true, quote-unquote, intended meaning of the text. But as I said earlier, this is a long-term work in progress. 50 years from now, understanding of the pyramid texts will be quite different from what it is today. Even if we have the basic gist now, there's going to be a lot of change in the finer details. If you are interested in that particular element, a scholar named James Allen, who is really focused on linguistics, is publishing a series titled A Grammar of the Ancient Egyptian Pyramid Texts. The first volume, covering the Tomb of Unas, was published in 2017. I'll put a reference in the episode description. From all that, you may be wondering, do we ever find new pyramid texts? Yes, actually. In 2010, the French excavation discovered the pyramid of Queen Behenu of the 6th dynasty. That pyramid had been almost completely destroyed over the centuries, as people took away the stone for building projects, so it was entirely buried in sand, just a low mound that you wouldn't necessarily notice. But when they excavated and identified it, they found that it was, in fact, originally a pyramid, and it has the underground chambers with pyramid texts. So new pyramid texts could easily be discovered in the future, just as Queen Behenu was discovered 130 years after the first identification. The point of all of this is that the pyramid texts are an evolving body of work. Scholarship is progressing, slowly but surely. Archaeologists are conserving and re-examining monuments, piecing together fragments that may have become separated from their original tombs. And most importantly, they are recopying the texts, with the benefit of the greater understanding that scholarship has acquired over the past century and a bit. So in 2024, the pyramid texts are an exciting field of Egyptological study. Have we reached the end of our understanding? Not by a long shot, but it's an exciting process, and who knows what the future holds. That brings us to the end of this discussion about the pyramid texts. One day, many years from now, I will probably revisit them. And if people are interested, I would like to do this more with other Egyptian religious work, the Book of the Dead or the Book of Gates, for instance. So if you have enjoyed this mini-series about Unas, do let me know in the comments or by emailing me at egyptpodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to learn more about the pyramid texts, you can find reference material in the episode description. Also, on Patreon, I do provide PDF booklets along with every episode. These include photos from my personal archive and extended notes based on my research. So if you would like to go deeper into the scholarship in a visually pleasing and aesthetic manner, you can find those on my Patreon. That's patreon.com/Egypt Podcast. On which note, I would like to thank the priests, my top-tier supporters on Patreon. These fine folks keep the offerings flowing. They ensure that the temples do not fall into ruin, and thus they guarantee that the deceased, whether king or commoner, make their journey to the next world to enjoy an immortal afterlife. I would like to thank Arthur, James, Veronica, Ashley, Stephen, Nadine, John, Kyla, Evan, Kendra, Jason, Andy and Chelsea, Kevin Cochran, Andrea, Mykost, Yola, TJ, Terry, Eric, Ellen, and Linda. Folks, thank you all so much for your generous support. You are endlessly generous, and I am in your debt. To everyone listening, thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you soon for some new episodes on a variety of small, interesting topics. For now, take care, and may the great gods of the sky know you, see you, and bless you. Thanks for listening.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.